Cool.
Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, February 22, 2010. Today on the agenda we have a number of items relating to the Office of Enterprise Technology. And the first item that we have is a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor regarding internal control and compliance audit of the Office of Enterprise Technology. Ms. Ferkel, welcome back to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor with the Financial Audit Division of the Legislative Auditor's Office. We're here today to talk to you about an audit that we issued last year about some of the financial operations of the Office of Enterprise Technology. I have with me Jim Reedy. He's one of our audit managers. He was responsible for this audit, and he'll go through the details of the audit with you.
Welcome to the Budget Division, Mr. Reedy. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission. I'm happy to be here today. My name is Jim Reedy. I'm an audit manager with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm here to present the results of our financial audit of the Office of Enterprise Technology. You should all have a copy of the report in your packets. This was the first financial audit that we did of the Office of Enterprise Technology after the legislature created the office and made it a cabinet-level position back in 2005. The report actually goes from, the scope of the report is July 1 of 2006 through April 30th of 2009, and we issued the report back in November. Just briefly, the objectives of the audit are typical of any financial audit that we do, where we're looking at whether or not the office safeguarded its assets and if it was producing reliable financial information. We also look to see that the office is in compliance with significant finance-related legal provisions. Overall, the conclusions on the report were that the office's controls were adequate, except for the area of equipment, where we had a negative conclusion. And except for the 8 findings in the report, we concluded that the office was in compliance with significant finance-related legal provisions that we tested. If you want to look at the table on page 4 of the report, I wanted to talk a little bit about the scope of the work that we did. This table presents 2 years of financial information for fiscal years 2007 and 2008. And again, although we went through 3 quarters of fiscal year 2009, we don't present that information in this table. But in the area of revenues, we looked at telecommunication services and computing services. You know, in total, those roughly are about $80 million of financial activity. And in the expense area, we looked at payroll, again, another significant line item for the office. It constitutes about $30 million a year, roughly about 30% of the office's budget. And we also looked at communications and computer and system services expenses. Again, those are fairly large line items within this portrayal of the office's financial operations. And we also looked at equipment that I mentioned just a minute ago. So I'm happy to entertain questions during the remarks that I'm going to make, so you can feel free to ask questions as we go through the report. I thought I'd just spend a few minutes introducing each of the 8 findings in the report. The first finding is on page 7, and it is kind of the capstone finding in the report. And what we concluded is that there were a lot of the findings and recommendations within the report that we think if the office would do a more comprehensive risk assessment and identification of its controls, and if it would establish a monitoring function to make sure that its controls were operating, it could have identified a lot of the problems that we report in the individual findings following this. And I'm sure many members of the committee will remember the initiative that was approved by the legislature last year, where the statewide internal control position was created within the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget, and it's to help these agencies with the technical requirements in implementing that type of a comprehensive risk assessment. So this finding relates specifically to that objective as well. Moving on to finding 2, that's on the same page, on page 7 of the report. And this is where we were talking about the, we had actually several findings related to equipment controls and lack of controls. We took a sample of about 20 sensitive assets and tried to trace those through the accounting records. And initially, we were having trouble with about half of the sample size. There were 11 sensitive assets that the office couldn't locate. And then after doing some work, it ended up being about seven assets, sensitive assets that they couldn't locate. So that's roughly about a third of the sample that we took. So that was the first problem. The other thing that we found is that the equipment records didn't have the specific identification information that would allow you to actually validate the accuracy of the accounting records. They didn't have physical location or specifications, model numbers, that type of information. And another part of this finding is the fact that they hadn't completed a complete physical inventory of the sensitive assets. Again, for state policy is 2 years. Their internal policy is every year, and they hadn't done a complete physical inventory of sensitive assets for over a 2 year period.
And Mr. Reby, I'm looking at the footnote on the bottom of page 8, just footnote number 7. You define a sensitive asset as generally for individual use that could be easily sold or most often subject to theft or misuse. I'm guessing we're talking about like laptops here. Is that what you're referring to?
Mr. Chair and members, that's a good example of a sensitive asset.
Okay. Thanks. Go ahead. Please proceed.
So those were the highlights of the types of issues that we found. So we made recommendations that they actually, the other problem was a lack of segregation of duties in the area of inventory control, where the managers who were responsible for the custody of the assets were also involved in taking the physical inventories so that if there were errors or irregularities, they could have been concealed. So that was another significant part of this finding. So we have several recommendations on page 9 for the office to actually address the weaknesses that I just described. So if there's no questions at this point, finding number 3 is on page 10. And what we found is that there was incompatible access or unnecessary access to several of the office's business systems. That would be the state's accounting system, the state's payroll system, and its accounts receivable system. And within each of those systems, we found a handful of people that had either unnecessary or incompatible access, and the office didn't have mitigating controls to address the risks related to those weaknesses. What's interesting about this finding is that the Department of Administration actually provides some support services to the Office of Enterprise Technology. And so we cite the Department of Administration as not having adequate controls over system access for the payroll work that it does on the behalf of the Office of Enterprise Technology. This is a fairly typical finding that we've reported to a lot of different state agencies, and we felt that the number of exceptions within each of the different business systems that I mentioned resulted in the written finding in this report.
And Mr. Ruby, on page 10, you're saying incompatible access exists when one employee controls the entire transaction or process. You say that there are 6 employees that had incompatible access to the accounting system and 4 employees with incompatible access to the accounts receivable subsystem, 1 employee with unnecessary access to that system because they don't know. Were these the same employees in both situations, or were they just different sets of employees?
Mr. Chair and members, they would be different employees because of the different business needs for each of those systems.
Okay. So there wasn't one employee that had incompatible access to both the accounting system and the accounts receivable system. There are different groups of people.
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct, because the accounts receivable system is a subsystem within the office.
Okay. But please proceed.
So on page 11, we basically recommend that the office address the incompatible duties that we identified in the report and that they develop a process to periodically review access to make sure that employees have only the level of access necessary to do their jobs, and that if there are instances where incompatible duties exist, that they should have mitigating controls to make sure that there are no errors or irregularities as a result of that lack of segregation of duties. Finding 4 is also on page 11, and we're talking about weaknesses in payroll in this finding. And again, as I mentioned, payroll represents about a $30 million line item on the office's budget. And the substance of this finding is that there's 3 key payroll reports, and the sample of the payroll reports that we looked at either didn't have evidence of review, or in the instances that there was documented evidence of review, we couldn't tell, you know, what follow-up procedures were taken on exceptions that were identified based on the review. Again, each of those reports has an objective to make sure that time is properly accounted for, that employees and supervisors are certifying the hours that have been worked, and that the payroll is input correctly, that people are being paid for the hours worked and at the appropriate compensation rates, and also that the payroll is actually charged to the right funding sources within the accounting system.
And apparently one of the backup approvers had left state government but was still listed as approval of the timesheets?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct, and I think there was about a 3-month gap from the time that the employee resigned and the time that we were doing the review of the payroll.
These are all obviously electronic timesheets, is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Again, with that, with this report, some of the responsibilities that that existed for the review of the payroll records and reports was with the Department of Administration. So part of this finding actually says that we believe that the office should update its interagency agreement with the Department of Administration to make sure that the expectations that the office has for the support that admin provides is accurate, and that there's no misunderstanding as to the control policies and procedures that the Office of Enterprise Technology expects the Department of Administration to follow through on.
Mr. Chair?
General C.
Would this be part of your scope of the review if there was some notice to the employees that the process wasn't done right, and maybe was there a letter put in the file or anything that you know of, kind of a disciplinary action for
Mr. Chair and Senator Alcein? The types of exceptions that would be identified in those reports would be, for example, with what the chair mentioned about a backup supervisor approving somebody's timesheet instead of the immediate supervisor approving the employee's timesheet. So the expectation would be that there would be a reason that backup approver approved the employee's timesheet, and some follow-up with the full-time supervisor to make sure that the payroll was processed accurately. It would be more of an example of that type of exception.
Go ahead.
Or if, for example, retro pay wasn't input at the right amount, that would be identified and resolved as part of the follow-up procedure.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, finding 5 is on page 13 of the report, and it deals with the lack of adequate safeguards over receipts that the Office of Enterprise Technology collects. You're probably aware of the fact that the Office of Enterprise Technology provides services to local units of government and nonprofit organizations, as well as state agencies. So they collect about $11 million a year in checks from those non-state entities. And there were several problems we identified with lack of physical security over the checks. They were kept in an unlocked area overnight before they were deposited. And at the point of entry, the mail room would actually log the checks, and that would be the first level of accountability, but nobody actually verified that the checks that were logged on the on that report were actually deposited in the bank then. And then another example of incompatible duties was where a person had access to the accounts receivable system, and also was responsible for preparing the deposit and taking the deposit to the bank.
Did you determine whether or not there's any losses or any missing funds as a result of this, or could you tell?
Mr. Chair and members, we did not identify any. That would not have been specifically an objective of ours, but the testing that we performed, there was no evidence of fraud or misappropriation.
Go ahead.
Okay, then finding six is on page 14 of the report. And, you know, as I mentioned, when we were looking at the table of financial activity, the office does collect a lot of revenues from the services that it provides. And for the most part, the testing that we did on the billings that the office prepares were accurate and the controls were adequate. But in the case of variable rate billings, they weren't able to provide us with the documentation so we could verify the accuracy of these variable rate billings. For the audit period, those variable rate billings constituted about $6 million of receipts. Again, out of the $80-plus million, it was less than 10%, but we felt that they needed to do a better job of documenting the allocation of the costs within these billings. And, you know, the billings are very complicated when you're dealing with telecommunications and computing services.
And these are billings that the Office of Enterprise Technology is making to other state agencies for providing the services, and the agencies pay it back to the OET?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. And then also the billings would relate to the not-for-profit and local units of government that are customers of the office as well.
So are you saying we can't quite tell if they were being underbilled or overbilled or properly billed or anything? Is that?
Mr. Chair, that's right. Actually, we talk about the fact that we had tested 26 variable rate billings. It's the last part of the first paragraph. And they couldn't provide adequate support for seven of the billings, and we did find some incorrect rates in four of the billings. So there were some examples of some errors within this revenue cycle.
Okay, go ahead.
Moving on to finding seven then, we're talking about segregation of responsibilities for the payments made outside of the regular state payment process. And, you know, in this case, what we found is that somebody had access to the accounting system and they could also go and physically pick up the check at the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. And that was a weakness that we identified. There was a fraud that occurred at the Department of Human Services where the level of access was similar. That was in the media probably a year ago or so, and the fraud was about $1 million in that case. So it was the same type of lack of segregation of duties here to a degree that we were asking the office to address the weakness in the recommendation that we reported on this finding.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the last finding is finding eight on page 15 of the report. And we had a couple of examples of interagency instances where Office of Enterprise Technology employees were doing services for other agencies, and there was a lack of a formal interagency agreement in those cases. We have some dollar amounts for the audit period. There was some services provided to the Department of Administration that totaled about $102,000 over that 2.75-year period, and some services to the governor's office as well. So we're just recommending in this case that they formalize those agreements, and in the office's response, they indicated that they had entered into an interagency agreement for fiscal year 10 with the governor's office at the time that we were issuing this report.
I mean, it kind of stands out that apparently these were areas where the governor's office asked for support and they would just send somebody on over and just not keep proper documentation of what they were doing or how much time they were spending on it.
Mr. Chair and members, I think it was a fairly standard practice. I think this employee devoted part of their workday to supporting the governor's office and, in the case of the Department of Administration. And the office actually has other interagency agreements, too, with other departments. Either the departments are providing services to the Office of Technology. We didn't find problems with those interagency agreements for the most part. They could have been amended or a little more up-to-date, but we didn't think it was a significant problem, so we didn't write up the agency for those, for the lack of interagency agreements in those cases. You know, state policy is actually more permissive in terms of state agencies entering into these types of arrangements, and so it's department policy that just suggests that those arrangements be formalized in a formal agreement.
Well, and as you may know, because I think you also have do some auditing of the governor's office, we've been trying to get an understanding of just how many people are actually working out of that office through interagency agreements. And so, you know, when somebody's under the radar screen and working out of the office and is not under an interagency agreement, I mean, it just, you know, it makes the problem even bigger. So we're trying to monitor that as well as you are, I think. So, okay.
Mr. Chair and members, we are aware of the reporting requirements that you're referring to.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah.
We also did an audit last year of the governor's office.
Right.
And we did also have this issue in their audit report that they had services through OET that they had not documented through an there always are two sides to interagency agreements.
Mm-hmm.
So we did have that in both agencies' reports.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any questions of the office or of the legislative auditor's office on this one? Does OET wish to make any comments on this? We've got the last couple of pages here submitted by Mr. Khanna. I'm just wondering whether or not if OET can tell us if these have been addressed or not. I mean, for instance, on page 18, under finding 5, about allowing some employees to have incompatible access, the response is the office should eliminate incompatibility access and should periodically monitor access. So you've gone through the process of eliminating it. Have you actually resolved these problems or not? So, Mr. Khanna, welcome back to the division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gopal Khanna. I'm the CIO for the state of Minnesota. Here to representing Office of Enterprise Technology, which is the state's lead agency providing information technology services to state agencies as well as other units of government. We really appreciate this opportunity, Mr. Chairman and members, to be here today to present to you this afternoon. We have put together a PowerPoint presentation for you, which and over the next few minutes we'll have my colleagues respond to the OLA audit as well as some of the other topics that you had invited us to come and talk about. So first order of the day would, of course, be asking my couple of my colleagues over here. To my left is the Chief Financial Officer of OET, Larry Freund. He, along with Michael Meilenberg, who's the Director of Legislative Affairs, will walk through the audit questions that you just raised, as well as what we plan to do in terms of governor's supplemental budget and adjustments and how we'll be managing them. In addition, we'll also have Chris Busey available to answer any questions pertaining to the audit. I have also here along with me this afternoon Tarek Toms, and Mr. Chairman, members, you have not met him before, because he's new to government. He joined OET about a year ago from the private sector. He'll be talking about the enterprise email project as well as some of our work in the area of enterprise software agreements. To get us started, I do have a couple of quick points to bring to your attention, and then I'll ask my associates over here to come up carry the conversation.
Well, again, before you give me a PowerPoint presentation,
yes,
the question is still out there. Which of these issues that have been identified by the legislative auditor have not been resolved?
Mr. Chairman, may I call upon the CFO, Larry Freund, to...
Mr. Freund, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Larry Freund. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Office of Enterprise Technology. And as far as your question there, we have implemented and resolved most of the findings here, with the exception of about three that we are working on right now. Some of them are more long-term resolutions. For instance, the number one there finding for the controls, overall controls, we're working with the Department of Management and Budget and going through that process of training employees on more of a long-term mitigation of risk in the department. And as far as some of the other findings in here, we have implemented new policies and procedures, and we are some of those take a little bit of time to implement and get those fully enacted there, and then we are working with the agencies to complete the interagency agreements. But other than that, we've implemented all the recommendations of the auditors.
What was the deal with the governor's office again? You're providing apparently a lot of assistance for it, and nobody was documenting anything.
Well, Mr. Chair, we have an employee with the Department of the Office of Enterprise Technology that works for the governor's office technology area there. We have a formal interagency agreement was processed this past year. So the first year and a half of that, we did not have an official document, but we've had one for over a year now. To document that agreement with the governor's office.
And on the inventory, the reference was made to sensitive materials. You know, I gave an example of laptops. I don't know what other items there are, but it seems to me that would be an easy one to start clamping down on, making sure you know what you've got, and if not, you're accounting for it.
Yes, Mr. Chair. What we are trying to do, what we are working on now, is to try to consolidate more of our assets into a single database to keep track of them. And we have been making the changes that the OLA has suggested that we do more of a overall audit of all our inventory of all our assets, and then having when there is an inventory. Not just having the managers work with a staff person, another staff person from the finance office to verify assets. And we are better tracking and documenting each of the assets as they come in and they move throughout the agency.
And being able to safeguard the receipts, I think that's something you should be able to do immediately.
Yes, we have a lockbox for those, and we are training the employees on different processes to
And the payroll trail, making sure that you...
Yes, Mr. Chair, what we've done at that, we've now, on a monthly basis, we send out reports to all the managers, so they have to verify each and every staff person in their area. Besides the point, right now, we have access through the internet that a manager approves the payroll each two-week period, but now we'll send them a copy to make sure that the funding source is correct, and we're asking each of them to keep a copy of that for the permanent record.
Any other questions before we go to the presentation? Let me just say, you know, there are some folks who want to try to consolidate technology and give OET, you know, a greater responsibilities, but you know, I think I want a cleaner bill of health before I want to start going that direction. I think you got to make sure you're doing what you're doing right at this time before we give you more work to do. So, anyway, Mr. Connor.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. As for your comment about controls, you're absolutely right. A well-run organization must have controls, and we really appreciate the good work done by OLA. And we take their work very seriously, and we have a team that has been responding aggressively to take care of not only controls that need to be put in place, but improve the performance, overall performance of the agency. Having said that, what we would like to do this afternoon, sir, is to go over several items, just a quick overview of our services, then talk about the 2010 supplemental budget adjustments, our enterprise email project, and where we are with it. We'll also talk about the enterprise software agreements, what we've been doing in terms of optimizing.
And I think you can assume, this budget division, of course, we've been together for the last 4 years, so I think we've got a pretty good idea of what OET does. So
You know, we'll skip that, sir.
Yeah, just give us the new stuff and how it impacts the budget areas. Go ahead.
And two more items. One would be talking about internal controls and compliance, again, adding to the this conversation. And finally, I'll be back for closing comments and to entertain your questions. So what I would like to do is, without further ado, straight away jump into talking about our 2010 supplemental budget.
Okay. Who's going to do that? Freund.
Mr. Chair. My name is Larry Freund, Chief Financial Officer for the Office of Enterprise Technology. Based on the governor's supplemental budget recommendations, OET is preparing a 3% reduction of our unspent fiscal year 10 general fund dollars and a 3% reduction of our 2011 operating budget. For the 2011 3% reduction, that equals a $169,000 reduction. And as far as how we're going to meet this OET, we will be reducing this, making this reduction by not filling positions. We held back a position during the last budget rounds because of the economy and the knowing of the budget reduction. So we're going to permanently hold back that position, and that cuts back on our salary costs. And then we're also going to hold back some of our operating and consulting costs that we use in the Enterprise Planning and Management Program. This would be typically our consulting costs are to try to move forward some enterprise initiatives on technology. So we'll just be holding back some of the costs on that to come up to this $169,000.
Does that include some of the security cuts, which I believe the governor is recommending? Didn't the governor recommend some cuts in the security
Mr. Chair, the security office took about a $95,000 reduction in the unallotments.
Okay.
And that...
the governor asked us to ratify them. That's correct, yeah.
Right.
Now, we also heard from the auditor about the fact that it's not quite clear if you're overbilling or underbilling agencies. If we can't get a handle on that, how does this factor into the 3% cut? I mean, you've got some fudge factors that are sitting in there that are kind of nebulous.
Mr. Chair, we are really working to improve that process. That was a small, as the auditor mentioned, that is a small amount of our revenues that they were looking at in this case here. And one of the things we have done now is we've got a new customer service unit in the agency it's really looking at that whole billing process as part of their responsibilities now. So what we'll end up doing with this is really documenting more of these kind of odd charges when there's a percentage increase based on a cost of a, if we provide a service to an agency, we get the actual cost and then add a percentage markup to cover the other, all the administrative costs of that. We're going to be better documenting that whole process and as we do the billing, right, in the billing system, we're going to be adding that documentation there so we have it in one place. So whenever we need to look at that, we can substantiate all our charges.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, our next presentation relates to enterprise email.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tarek Tomes. I am an assistant commissioner responsible for the customer and service management division within the Office of Enterprise Technology. And I'm excited today to provide two presentations of interest for you, one on the enterprise email consolidation project and one on the value of enterprise software licensing agreements.
Now, is this an area where you also charge agencies for one of the services that you do?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay, go ahead.
The enterprise email project is a project that is concluding. It is a project that's been underway for a couple of years now, with the goal of the project being to consolidate the enterprise messaging services of the executive branch, approximately 32,000 users, into a single messaging system that is highly available, redundant, and secure, with a broad set of collaboration capabilities enabling calendaring, scheduling, and directory access capabilities. So far from a project update, The numbers that are on the slide, Mr. Chairman, are incorrect. They need to be updated just a little bit. The actual numbers are 21 of 24 agencies have migrated, with the remaining three agencies slated to complete the migration by June of 2010. The three agencies that are remaining to be migrated are DPS, DHS, and MDE. From a project perspective, from the start of the enterprise email consolidation effort, there were 30 plus separate email environments consisting of 200 plus servers. There were four different email platforms, which essentially is the software that runs the messaging platforms, which provided a very complex environment for the messaging systems to communicate with one another. There was inconsistent or difficult to document availability and security services surrounding the messaging services. Little to no common or shared calendaring capabilities. There was not a statewide directory as it relates to the ability to authenticate users centrally and provide that directory information centrally. And there was not a comprehensive disaster recovery capability for the messaging service. When the system is fully migrated, and most of these characteristics currently exist already, even in lieu of the remaining three agencies to be migrated, it is a single messaging system, highly available. It's redundant in two data centers with 24/7, 365-day support, a common directory and calendaring environment, and improved metrics to measure the effectiveness and utilization of email. It will provide for a greater ability to predict costs and the investment in this critical communication mechanism, and it will flatten out the ability for agencies to understand their future costs for providing or receiving messaging services.
So far, do you know where the costs are going up or going down to implement the new system for the agencies?
Mr. Chairman, members, in consolidating a messaging platform as complex as email, which is a critical communication mechanism for the executive branch, the costs for providing the service have not gone up, but there are a number of key characteristics that are now provided from a messaging perspective that were not available before, like the redundancy features and functionalities. There is a cost avoidance aspect to it in the future as it relates to future upgrades that will now only have to happen in one environment. I think from a cost perspective, the costs are not going up, and the costs are being now moved to enable a greater set of functionality for the executive branch.
So you're saying the costs are not going up to implement the system?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
The next slide, Mr. Chairman and members, are a few slides that just provide some metrics, some information as it relates to where the messaging service is currently. There are currently slightly over 25,000 mailboxes being served on the messaging environment. There are approximately 300 million messages that are received on a daily basis. The next two slides are a little bit a consolidation. There are approximately 300 million messages being received on the messaging service, and with the perimeter message protection services that we provide surrounding it, we block approximately 90% of those messages, which are actually spam and messages that are intended as virus or spam. From a value on investment perspective, the consolidation of messaging services has done a number of very fundamental things. It has improved the security and disaster recovery posture from a messaging perspective by providing multiple data centers with highly available messaging servers. It has improved our ability from a malware and spam perspective to protect the executive branch. It has improved employee productivity by enabling remote access capabilities for accessing the messaging service externally, as well as providing cross-agency calendaring and scheduling and directory services. There is a large cost avoidance potential as it relates to leveraging hardware and software purchases more effectively and by centralizing the administration and support and training services down to one messaging environment. And it really does lay a very strong foundation for improving the effectiveness and communication capabilities within the executive branch by allowing everyone to take advantage by pooling the resources that have been put into the messaging environment, by allowing everyone to really have a messaging platform that has the most advanced characteristics that are possible. Mr. Chairman, we would like to provide a short video. We coordinated with your staff the presentation of a short video from one of the agencies, the Department of Transportation, that they put together as it relates to the migration of messaging services.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Transition has been difficult for some, but the training that was provided for all of us was an excellent training module, and they continued to ask us what else we needed. I think the whole transition team did an excellent job with Outlook.
And you know, when I came in on Monday morning here, and everything worked well, the Outlook, when I switched it on, there was a little bit of a login period, but everything worked really, really well. There was no significant worries. Everybody got their emails, everybody got their calendar, everybody got their notices and whatever else. It was due to all the preparation that our IT staff did for us to lead up to the opening day of having Outlook available for us.
Well, one of the Outlook features I enjoy is the calendar system. They have two different types. One is the calendar view, where you can view other people's or resources' calendars, and if you have multiples open, you can overlay them to find available dates of availability for individuals or resources.
You know, I anticipated quite a few challenges and changes, and you know, the first morning when I logged in, I had a little bit of a problem, so I called and I said, what's going on? And they knew exactly what was happening, and talked to them for a couple minutes on the phone. They were able to make the fix, and I was up and running within about 5 or 10 minutes. So there was a little bit of a blip there. And then my BlackBerry needed to be synced, and so I called them. I said, how do I get my BlackBerry all synced up? And they said, bring it on down. And I had my BlackBerry back within 20 minutes. I was just delighted with how quickly they were able to recover and help me with my questions.
I'm not the most software literate person, so I expected more difficulty than I had. Actually, it was so easy, I thought I was missing something. And it's working well. There are a lot of features, like I said, I don't use. I haven't gotten to yet. I just haven't had the time. But I know they're there, and every now and then I discover something new as I'm in process of learning, and it's great. I love it.
Hello, everybody. Sorry I can't be with you today. I'm at TRB this week, but I sure wish I could be there and be part of your celebration. You know, this is a great celebration, our transition from GroupWise to Outlook. It's a pretty remarkable accomplishment, and particularly in the amount of time that we performed this transition. I will share with you that I went through this personally when I worked for the USDOT. We got direction from the department that all modal agencies needed to transition to Outlook, and I was personally involved with that. I went through many of the same things that you all did as I transitioned my account from GroupWise.
Oops.
Many of the same things that you have learned to date, and you will continue to learn in the future. And I know it's been difficult. I know it's very, very hard to get email sizes down. I know it's been very hard to manage these accounts and with different constraints than you've had in the past. So I know this is a difficult time and a difficult thing to go through. But I will tell you, as I went through it with USDOT, in the end, I felt very good about it. I felt very good about the transition to the new Outlook program, and I felt that the new Outlook was actually more effective than GroupWise as I used it in the past. So we've done a lot of work to get to where we are today. We had 7 months of planning processes. We worked very closely with OET, and I think we should give ourselves a pat on the back for that strong collaboration that occurred amongst people that really helped pull this off, and give yourselves a pat on the back for all the work you did to make this a reality. You know, one of our biggest obstacles as we transitioned was the delivery schedule. That when we reduced the delivery schedule from March 2010 to November 2009, there were many challenges in doing that. I think one of our biggest success was the use of innovative technologies. You know, we used automated remote workstation software upgrades that really eliminated the need to visit every desktop, and I think that was pretty significant. We also used Adobe Connect, which allowed MnDOT OET employees and the consultants from three different states to work together nights and weekends from home. You know, I think we all know this, but desktop tools are a critical part of our business right now and a critical part of the way we communicate. Email is an essential component of the way we communicate amongst ourselves and with our customers. And we know that 90% of our employees use email every day, and it's absolutely essential to the effectiveness of our organization. So I really want to commend you again for all the help and all your patience and diligence and transitioning to Outlook. And I really, really hope you enjoy your celebration today. Thank you.
When do we start the celebration?
Well,
where's the champagne?
Isn't there a cost going from GroupWise to Microsoft Outlook, though?
Mr. Chairman, the migration costs are really split into a couple of different categories. So there are the software licensing costs as it relates to the licenses, just the software licenses needed on the destination platform, in this case Outlook. And then there are costs associated with migrating your existing information or existing data. And many of the agencies did an incredible job really working through complex scenarios to take an opportunity to clean up data at times and really to get themselves into a good position to minimize the financial impact of migrating their information to the new messaging platform.
But the programs themselves, I mean, I think the Senate uses GroupWise, and the reason why we don't have another program is because it's fairly cheap, and it'd be very expensive for us to get another to go to Outlook.
Mr. Chairman, in what we found in most instances, the Department of Transportation was an example of this. The licensing maintenance costs from their current messaging platform, in that case GroupWise, really offset the costs related to the move to enterprise email and the software licensing costs required by the new messaging platform.
Okay, go on.
Okay. Thank you. The next couple of slides are regarding enterprise software agreements and the benefits and rationale behind enterprise software agreements. The state of Minnesota, we sign a variety of enterprise software agreements in areas where there are tremendous advantages, either by aggregating the resources used to purchase those agreements, or by allowing us to set standards that allow for better cross-platform collaboration. Examples of enterprise software agreements that have been signed are software licensing, the geographical information systems, and really critical security-related software tools, such as the enterprise and vulnerability management system. Rationale reasons, some of the reasons to pursue enterprise licensing agreements: reduce costs by pooling resources and being able to negotiate with vendors based on bulk purchasing potential. Uniform software standards for the executive branch, which really has a tremendously large impact in the sense that not only does it drive uniformity, but it also reduces training costs, allows employees to move between agencies potentially while still using the same stack, and allows for collaboration between agencies in a more streamlined manner, and a more streamlined process for supporting and upgrading the software tools. Some of the specific enterprise software agreements is the Geographical Information System Software Agreement. It's provided by a vendor, ESRI. It is a flat fee licensing agreement, if you will, that provides for access to the executive branch for a flat fee. And it's software that's used to track where federal stimulus funds go, as well as it was also used in preparation for mitigation evacuation plans for the Red River floods of 2009. Another example of an enterprise software agreement that has been put into place is the enterprise software agreement with Microsoft, which provides access to the 32,000 users in the executive branch, really to the broad office productivity suite that Microsoft provides. We previously had a similar spin to what the Microsoft Enterprise Agreement was that covered approximately 10,000 users for a reduced set of services and software tools. So essentially for the same spend, we enabled a broader set of capabilities as well as an upgrade path to future capabilities for the same spend.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Who's that, Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, members, we covered the audit, but if you have additional questions, sure. We would be open to those at this time.
Okay. Okay, any questions before we get to the budget side of OET? Apparently not. Mr. Donna, did you want to talk about the budget?
We've covered all of our items with the budget piece. Okay. Was covered by the CFO earlier when we started. And I'm now open for any general questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I guess one thing that I'm concerned about, getting back to the agencies that you're billing, I think it'd be a little bit helpful to us if we had some idea of what the agencies have been paying and previously what they're paying now, because again, I think we got other budget divisions trying to set, you know, their targets and their budgets, and of course part of what they have to devote is what goes to you. So I may get to see it, you know, what you're charging at other agencies, but I don't know if the other budget chairs are quite cognizant about what's going on there as the other agent other budget divisions are trying to put together budgets. You know, there's money passing forward back and forth between the agencies and you, and I'm trying to get a better handle on what those monies are, even if it's relatively small. So,
any from Frank's perspective,
Mr. Chair? Yeah, we can provide you with information on that. One thing to remember now is with the services that OET provides here, they choose to use OET, and then we bill them based on a usage factor. So. It's not that we just bill them a dollar amount for a range of services. It's pretty specific on what they require or request us to do, and then we charge them. But we can provide information on the agencies, what we receive in revenue from the agencies.
But if I understood the auditor correctly, you know, we're not clear whether you're overbilling or underbilling or what's actually going on with some of your billing. So we want to get a better fix on what you're doing there.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay,
we can send you the auditor. So. Okay. Anything further, Mr. Collin?
Well, the final comment that I have, an offer, if there are any more questions on the subjects we have covered this afternoon. But, Mr. Chairman, we are most grateful to you and the members, and with your help and the governor's leadership, we've come a long ways in terms of setting up controls, process, procedures within OET and making it an organization that can not only serve the state agencies, but take a much larger view of state government as a whole. I'm not sure how many of you saw the CNN program over this past weekend on cybersecurity and threats, and it was a very real simulation exercise, extremely well done, with a collection of some extremely knowledgeable people in the area of public policy, both Republicans and Democrats. The bottom line is there's a lot of threat to the nation from cybersecurity perspective. In state government, while that was not covered by CNN, our work really, and what we've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years has really been cutting edge in the sense that we're taking the right approach by taking a more of a centralized approach, more of a approach of taking a look at government as a horizontal entity from a technology perspective. Enormous amount of work has to be done. Email project is one example. It has taken many years for us to get where we are. And we're still 3 or 4 months away from saying, yes, we have completed the full project and brought everybody under one unified communications approach. That's going to be key to our delivery of services going forward in government. Likewise, finding ways to optimize our relationships with our vendor partners and looking for ways to coming up with enterprise licenses, and one of the licenses that was not cited was something that Chris Busey, the state chief information officer, a security officer, had entered into, whereby other units of government can buy security tools through that agreement. So what we're trying to do is create a mechanism for not only reducing the cost of government from a technology perspective, but to start seeing it as a resource center, so that as investments are made, we can bring more value on investment and improve the capabilities and performance and secure the data and information, which is the key asset of government. Going forward, no government services can be delivered without securing our data and information assets, just as 50, 70 years ago, we could not deliver government services without having brick-and-mortar buildings where we could house employees, but today we need this asset base. So it has to be seen as a resource center, as a program, IT as a program, and with that, we really appreciate all the good work that has been done on the part of my team, but thank you all again.
Any other questions of OET? Thank you. Let's see, Wednesday, we've got what, Department of Administration in? Gambling Control Board, but not the lottery. And maybe the lottery, okay. The governor has a proposal on lottery games. We asked them if they'd come on, give us a better understanding explanation for it. But otherwise, we're still going to be looking at budget proposals for Department of Administration, the Gambling Control Board, maybe the lottery on Wednesday. Okay, anything else that we're going to do then? Okay. Nothing further? Okay, meeting's adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, that was it?
Yep.
You're just missed.